This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there, how are you? This hour, BCI Minerals is going to build a pilot plant to produce sulphate of potash fertiliser at its Mardy salt operations about 80 kilometres south of Karratha. The main business is still going to be salt production, but it's a pretty exciting opportunity if they can successfully produce the fertiliser as a byproduct, which will obviously have benefits for the farming community, the agricultural sector. Also today, the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, could have a problem on its hands with the noise and vibrations from its brand new locomotive trains. We'll get to that shortly before the news headlines at 12:30. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC WA. First up today, one of the largest players in the WA fruit industry says the federal government's decision to slow the process of visa applications for working holiday makers is likely to put off workers coming to Australia. The temporary visa allows young people from overseas to fill labour shortages while travelling in Australia and are a key source of labour for the agricultural sector and Australia's food security. Nicole Giblett is the director of Newton Orchards in Manjimup in the state's southwest, growing, packing and supplying local and export markets with apples, avocados and cherries. Nicole, what's your response to the government hitting pause on these visas?
Just a bit bamboozled by Belinda, because we just can't see any reason why it would be a positive in any regard, and quite the opposite. It just looks like yet another onerous directive that's going to most impact rural employers. It's increasingly difficult these days to get Australians to do monotonous farm and pack house work, and we're heavily reliant on backpackers and these holiday maker visas, and have been, will be for as long as I can see. And just a bit puzzled as to why this has come about.
How important are these workers on the backpacker or holiday maker visas to your business?
To my business, and I can probably speak on behalf of other pack houses in the region, they're critical because, we always prioritise hiring Australian residents wherever we can, but there's just simply not enough wanting this kind of work. So without backpackers, then the palm scheme workers work and fit beautifully into our orchard system, but it's more difficult managing their hours in the pack house. So, without backpackers, it would be, I'd be heading back to COVID days of difficulty. I don't actually want to envisage how difficult that would be.
What impact do you think that just the slowdown at this point, a slowdown in the processing of these visas, will have on backpacker interest or the numbers coming or wanting to work on Australian farms?
The slowdown, I mean, aside from the cost, seems to be outrageous. And to hit that $1,000 barrier, there's that mental barrier as well, that just for the 2 and 3 years returning. And they're the staff that you'd love to get, because they've already got some, often already have some relevant experience. So your training costs are reduced if you don't have to start from scratch. But time is frustrating, so I think that might be an additional factor, but I probably see the upfront costs as being the one that will initially just have them going to New Zealand instead, or heading off to Bali earlier than they planned.
So how much has the cost of the visa gone up, Nicole?
Don't be quoting me, but I thought the second and third years went up almost 50% to $1,000, but this is just what we've been tossing around, these figures, and haven't spoken to our backpackers we've got here at the moment, but I know they'll be howling, and I can only imagine that it will definitely have an impact, particularly on that move after they first finish their first year, that they won't come back for year 2 and 3.
What message does it send, do you think, even just with the slowdown of the processing of the visas?
It's just adding another layer of complexity for them that just makes it too hard. Like, it's already extremely difficult and expensive, what it was previously. So, you know, there's only so much tolerance that everyone has to put up with this. I had some backpackers in our pack house living with me for a few months last year, and they were going through their second application. It was really onerous. And I mean, they were great young Italian workers who wanted to continue in our region. But yeah, so I'm just perplexed as to why this move has been instigated.
This is the Country on the ABC WA. 11 past 12. Nicole Giblett is here today. She's the director of the family-owned apple, avocado and cherry business, Newton Orchards in Manjimup. And we're talking about the federal government's decision to slow the process of visa applications for working holiday makers, which is a crucial workforce for the horticulture industry and others. Nicole, do you think this go slow on the visas is a precursor to cutting the numbers on the visa?
I would hope not, because although, yes, every year where there are surplus to our, to the needs in the region, not every backpacker can get work here during our peak season in the Southern Forest, but, you know, a large amount of them do, and you kind of need surplus because not everyone is suited to the work either. So, you know, they might not be on board for a couple of weeks and then realise they're just, you know, it's not for them and they'll move on. So, you know, we need a surplus. I don't see that the numbers now are excessive. And, you know, I know that there's other industries that need them as well, so hospitality, et cetera. Yeah, I'm at a loss to explain it, Belinda.
Well, a lot of the debate around this is obviously focused on Australia's net overseas migration, so the numbers coming in. But it looks like this visa has been caught up in that particular debate. Are you surprised by that? It's kind of been caught up in this bigger political debate underway.
Because they're not, you know, they're nothing to do with Australia's immigration levels, and you know that's a topic that's outside the discussion point for my industry. But again, it's just almost bordering on nonsensical if that's the way it's been tagged. It should have been looked at separately, and it needs to be as a way of, you know, shoring up and servicing our food security industry. So it's nothing more simple than that you're having an impact on your domestic food security if you are further upsetting its reliable labour sources. And they're already under enough pressure when they're trying to, you know, these itinerant workers are trying to find reasonable accommodation, which is, you know, scarce and high value.
And that's part of the debate too, isn't it, Nicole? Because this, the conversation around migration is directly linked to Australia's housing shortage. So just on for your business as an example, the backpackers that you employ, are they renting homes in the local community, or do they have accommodation on the property?
We fully accommodate our orchard palm workers. That's been necessary because there hasn't been suitable or available accommodation elsewhere in the region. We also, you know, wherever we're recruiting, you know, managerial staff from outside of the region, then we're, you know, running around trying to shore up their accommodation as well, because you just can't leave these things to chance. But the backpackers generally are still in like the backpacker hostel type accommodations, which are full down here in peak periods, as I understand. And then there's quite a lot of local homeowners who've then set up whatever the Shire maximum is, and potentially more than that in one house. All paying there's a standard rent of, I think it's like 170 per person per room is sort of the agreed regional price that they pay. And that's generally when they get to be second and third year, they get a bit obviously more savvy and connected and are able to find that share housing, which is a lot more reasonable, a lot less expensive than staying in a hostel.
And from the workers that you've had through your business and your farm over the years, how many of them actually end up staying in Australia?
I can hardly think of any, like maybe one or two out of the whole time. They all go home. Our vast experience of working holiday makers is they're not people who are caught up in the situations in their home countries of needing to eventually worm their way into refuge in Australia. They're all quite relatively well supported from home and wanting to go back to home the end of the 3 years.
So. Where are the ones on your property at the moment from? Which countries?
Usually these days it's predominantly French and Italian. Yeah, in the past we've gone through the Estonians and Germans and lots of nationalities, but just when visa implications swing between different countries. But yeah, we have a lot of, and it's great having them around, like a young crew, and they're here for a bit of fun together as well. So yeah, they're always very welcome at our business, and I hope that the extra expense and layers of compliance doesn't put too many of them off. But I think, yeah, we might be perhaps in for a bit of a rough ride. And probably what it means is the numbers will definitely reduce, and then it's going to cost us more anyway, because you might end up now having to retain someone who's not a particularly, you know, financially viable staff member, because you've just got to have someone on the spot on the line, as opposed to, you know there's no one behind them looking for their job, and so they have less incentive to really put all of their effort into being on the job and doing their best. It's probably another slightly convoluted way that this might go.
How confident are you that this will be sorted out quickly? And these workers under this scheme will be business as usual.
That's very opaque, Belinda. I have no idea. I hope that there is some pushback from industry, and you know, I'm sure that we've got very good advocacy with our peak body, that they'll be collaborating with National Farmers Federation to push back heavily on this, because it's not a wise move.
Nicole, great to have you on the Country Hour. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Belinda. Bye.
Nicole Giblett is the director of Newton Orchards in Manjimup. So producing and packing a range of fruits, apples, avocados and cherries, and talking about the challenges that might be on the way from this go slow on the working holidaymaker visa that's been put in place by the federal government. 18 past 12. Well, it's a very similar story further north of the state, where backpackers on working holidaymaker visas play a critical role in the day-to-day operations at the Sweet of Banana Cooperative in Carnarvon. Doriana Mangili is the business manager at the co-op, which is owned and operated by 20 family-run farms on the banks of the Gascoyne River. She's looked at sourcing workers through the PALM scheme, which allows businesses to hire workers from 9 Pacific countries and Timor-Leste when there's not enough local workers. But at this stage, the working holidaymaker visa is the best fit, and any changes to it would have serious consequences.
On our growers' farms, they're mostly family run, so they may have maybe 1 to 2 people, or sometimes it's just mum and dad working the farm and they don't have any staff at all. They may need somebody seasonally to help when things get busy. In our packing shed, it is mostly backpackers. We have a number of local workers, like a core team of staff that work with us all year round. And then the rest are backpackers that are here for, 3 to 6 months and then move on to other places. Sometimes they come back to us. But, yeah, we are mostly employing backpackers. We have looked at the PALM worker scheme and we're going to dip our toe in the water, but it requires a whole lot of other overheads. You have to have a specific welfare officer, and you've got to make sure that you've got enough work to give people, over 30 or 35 hours a week consistently for the whole time that they're here. And that is just not something we can guarantee with the volumes that we have. So even if we are successful in applying and becoming part of the PALM scheme, we would still be supplementing that with backpackers, because they can provide the flexibility around the set hours you need for PALM workers.
What could this mean for future production?
It's just another thing that's going to make farming really hard. Food is grown in remote and regional areas far away from cities. Many Australians and young people don't want to work in horticulture and farming. They move to the city, they move out of regional areas for education and employment. And if we've got less workers to harvest and pick, it's quite possible that, you know, we'll see the end of that small-scale family-run farming, where it will only be the big guys, big corporations that can farm, because they're the ones that can get the workers.
Could this affect prices of crops when they go to market as well?
Oh, look, you know, pricing is something we don't really control because it's supply and demand. But sure, if there are less products on the shelf because farmers can't harvest them, then of course there'll be shortages and prices will go up. So I think we're already dealing with so much with weather and climate. You know, we lost most of our crop, 90% of our crop earlier this year in two cyclones. So the challenges just keep coming. So you would hope that government would be looking to say, how do we make fresh Australian food more accessible to Australians, not putting things in the way of doing that.
Business manager at the Sweeter Banana Cooperative, Doriana Mangili, speaking to Nikki Bailey. 21 past 12, Richard Shannon is the National Farmers Federation's horticulture spokesperson. He says the federal government needs to take the handbrake off the working holidaymaker visas.
We have a delegation coming to Canberra in a couple of weeks' time. Hopefully it's not too late, but before then we'll be taking every step possible to implore government gives us due consideration and considers the risk to food security and also the upward pressure likely to come on the cost of fresh produce in supermarket aisles. One thing I'll add to this, at the very start of the first Labor term of government, the Prime Minister made a lot about restoring trust in government. And I think the Prime Minister then diagnosed what we now see is a fracturing of support, particularly for major parties, right? And a large part of that is meant to provide transparency, particularly to those most affected by government changes. And here we've got a government making changes in the background, not being upfront with industry about what they're doing and the extent to which that might affect the industry. And we need to expect better of our government.
The National Farmers Federation's Richard Shannon, 22 past 12. The Premier, Roger Cook, has also entered the conversation, saying he's made the point to the Commonwealth that WA needs a strong, skilled migration program for a range of different industries.
We have had direct conversations with the Commonwealth around the importance of making sure that we have a strong skills migration program in Western Australia. I share those concerns with the Premier of South Australia, Peter Malinauskas. Both Peter and I are confronting situations of growing economies, workforce shortages and anticipated need for workers into the future as the lead up to our role in the AUKUS partnership. In his case, it's getting workforce housing services in place in relation to the Osborne facility and the future construction of nuclear subs. In Western Australia, for us, it's the growing economy everywhere, whether it's agricultural resources or defence industries. And so we have a need for more workers. But look, can I just say, the federal government is working in a very difficult political landscape at the moment. You have this tsunami of right-wing populism being fanned by the Liberal Party as they cede all their policy authority to One Nation. And you have to think about the difficulties which the federal government has in navigating this. You have this ridiculous debate on the East Coast around migration into Australia. We know that in Western Australia, we need to have more skilled migrants. We need to continue to boost our workforce. We love our multicultural society and the way it enriches our community more generally. Our horticulture and our agriculture industries rely upon overseas workers to be able to come in to work on their farms and in their fields. And, you know, we know that hospitality, tourism, in Western Australia, rely upon overseas workers, particularly people on working holiday visas, you know, and from that perspective, there could be a very, very serious impact. But again, I mean, if people want to have a proper debate around skills migration, I welcome that. But what we are seeing at the moment is this ridiculous shrill noise coming from the Liberal Party and One Nation at the moment around the immigration debate.
The Premier, Roger Cook, speaking on The Morning Show with Nadia Mitsopoulos earlier today, 12:24. You seem keen to jump in on the conversation on this, on the federal government's decision to slow down the processing of the working holiday maker visas. So be part of the conversation on the text 0448 922 604. Mike says the government knows backpackers don't vote, so they're not important to this socialist Labor government. Margaret in Collie says this is just Labor's attempt to show they're reducing migration while not actually doing anything. They know with their mass migration from certain ethnicities, they can guarantee they stay in power. Luke in the Wheatbelt says the Labor snake's at it again, punishing good and productive people like temporary working visitors and avoiding the real issue. And this too, some people are exploiting backpackers by having three couples renting in one house, paying $200 each. It means there is less housing for locals and the people I need to run my business. Put your name and your location on the text 0448 922 604. 26 past 12.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
The state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, could have a problem on its hands with the noise and vibrations from its brand new locomotive trains. On Friday's Country Hour, CBH's Chief Operations Officer, Mick Dore, gave you the specs on the 17 new custom-built narrow-gauge locomotives and the 650 wagons that will help move grain from farms to its four ports. The new locos were getting lots of compliments from State Transport Minister Rita Saffioti because they have better lighting than the older models. But Kristen Truman from Mount Barker in the Great Southern says just in the last few weeks, she's noticed a big difference in the amount of noise and vibrations coming from CBH's new trains.
I didn't actually know what it was when we first heard it. It was sort of late at night, and it's a really sort of bassy rumble that it makes the house feel almost like an earthquake. Not like a severe earthquake, but we've had earthquakes nearby before, and it's a similar kind of feeling where the house just kind of rumbles quite loudly. And we are 5 kilometres from the train line. So we've been here 15 years and have never so much as heard a train until now. Basically, from what I understand, CBH have said that anybody who is experiencing these, you know, disturbances can email them, and to keep a bit of a log of when they're hearing it and the duration and things like that. So that's pretty much all I've been doing, is just noting down the time and the duration. And sometimes it's been up to 15 minutes long that I can still hear it. But yeah, I'm just shocked because it's so far away. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought we would hear it here.
Kristen Truman speaking to Peter Barr about train noise and vibrations at around 10 and 11 o'clock at night, and also sometimes at around 6 o'clock in the morning. Alexandra Spargo has a similar story. For the last 4 years, she's lived on a hill about a kilometre away from Mount Barker, and says up until a few weeks ago, she was never woken up by any trains. But that's changed with CBH's new locos.
It's a lot louder than what the trains used to be before, because I don't mind hearing the train. You get used to it after a while, but just lately it's louder. It's just really loud rumbling, and my windows vibrate. And so, and also they toot their horn a lot longer than the other guys, the other trains. I don't know why, but yeah.
So they're tooting at 3:14 in the morning, and it's what, literally rumbling the house?
Yeah. Like I've got a nice old cottage, and it's up on stumps, and I've had it renovated. My brother and I did a lot of renovations here when I first moved here 4 years ago, and so it's all newly painted, everything's been fixed, all the dents and whatever, and I've just noticed I've got this long crack in the ceiling now right at the front where the windows are, so I'm not happy about that.
Alexandra Spargo lives about a kilometre away from Mount Barker. She was speaking to Stan Shaw about the noise and vibrations coming from CBH's new locomotives. A request for an interview has been placed with the CBH group, but at this stage it's only sent a statement. It says CBH is aware some residents located near the rail corridor, particularly in the Mount Barker area, have reported different noise and vibration associated with recent train movements. CBH has been gathering specific information from residents and working with Horizon and ARC Infrastructure to help understand when and where the issue is occurring and looking into a range of potential contributing factors, including train operation, local track condition, and also the weather. Geoffrey Higham is a WA-based train expert who's written some books on them. He says it will be in everyone's best interest for CBH, Horizon and ARC Infrastructure to properly investigate these complaints.
The locomotives, which is probably the noisiest part of a train, have quite a different sound, I'm told. I haven't actually heard them out on the track yet. They've only been doing trials. But they're built in Brazil with General Motors engines. So they're a different brand and a different motor to the existing CBH trains. So
is it unexpected, Geoffrey, for there to be an increase in noise and even a creation of vibrations when it comes to new engines like this?
Yes, it can happen. And indeed, there were many complaints some years ago when the modern fleet of electric trains came in for the Perth Metropolitan trains in 2007, that they were causing vibrations, but that was ironed out fairly easily. The new locomotives, as I understand it, they're mainly really doing trials around the system, and they are, of course, more powerful, and particularly your colleague mentioned Kendon up. Now, that's on quite a strong hill climb up from Mount Barker, so they would be working quite hard going up that hill. Since they're more powerful, there is a bigger diesel engine in them, and they may well make more noise, I guess.
Okay.
Vibration's less common, but that would be something that could be investigated. You can't easily change the engine, but certainly if there's vibration, I'm sure they'll, between the track owner, or which is ARC, and the operator of other trains, Horizon and CBH, who have bought these, I'm sure they'll be looking into that. Of course, the vibration generally will not be good for the track either, apart from your listeners. So I'm sure there will be some investigation. ARC will complain if there's too much vibration in their track.
I wonder if there's a solution to that. Any ideas? Shoot them through on the text, how to reduce that noise and vibration of those new locos. 0448 922 604, 28 to 1. That was Geoffrey Higham, who's written some books on trains. He was speaking there to Peter Barr. Let's get an update from the newsroom. Tony Carr is in the studio. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The chairman of the Sydney Swans, Andrew Pridham, has apologised after the club found five players involved in an incident in a Melbourne hotel early on Monday morning breached the club's expected standards. The Swans board met last night and decided on a sanction that involved the banning of Riley Bice, Nick Blakey, Isaac Heaney, James Jordan and Chad Warner for the rest of the season. WA Premier Roger Cook says discussions with the federal government about the importance of skilled migration to Western Australia are ongoing. The federal government is poised to announce a significant overhaul of the country's migration settings, with other political parties pushing for lower overall numbers. And WA's Emergency Services Commissioner Darren Clem says much of the state faces an increased fire risk due to heavy fuel loads and dry soil. Mr Clem says areas surrounding Exmouth, the Ashburton Coast, Kalbarri and Three Springs will have increased fuel loads, resulting in heightened fire risk. He says a dry winter has left parts of the southwest with a soil moisture deficit. Belinda, I'll be back with some more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for that, Tony. 27 to 1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
And this on the CBH locos and the noise and vibrations from Franco, who says, send the trains out to the wheat belt. We'll be happy to have our bins all empty. Sounds like a bit of a NIMBY situation in Mount Barker. The text 0448 922 604. Making our way now to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Bob Tarr is with you today. Bob, how's it looking across northern and eastern parts?
Yeah, so in the north, the southern parts of the north, we have a cloud band extending from the Gascoyne into the northern goldfields and then the interior, and just some isolated showers associated with that cloud band today. But in the coming day or two, we will see that cloud band start to thicken up and could see more in the way of showers and areas of rain as we go forward into tomorrow, especially tomorrow over the northern part of the Gascoyne. So sort of around Carnarvon and areas to the north of there could see some decent falls, as well as southern parts of the Pilbara, and that'll continue into Friday, and then all that will just gradually contract towards the east, but could see some reasonable shower and thunderstorm activity over the weekend across the interior as well. Across the Kimberley, just pretty settled conditions, not really too much in the way of wind, and just some areas of fog over the northwest in the mornings, but all in all pretty seasonal, maybe just a bit warmer than normal for this time of year. That's the north and east.
Let's move into the Southwest Land Division. Give us the details for the next few days, Bob, and any more developments on that front coming over the weekend.
Yeah, so it's probably not great news on that front. We have had a front move through the southwest corner of the state. It did bring a little bit of rain. It's brought some rain to many areas, but in terms of more substantial rain, it's really just been limited to the southwest capes, where we have seen some falls up to about 12 mils around Margaret River, but falls certainly dropping off as that front has moved towards the north and east. Just some isolated residual showers over the southwest corner for tomorrow, a very light falls associated with those, and then we'll have dry weather with some warmer temperatures pushing in on Friday, and then on Saturday a trough down the west coast, slight chance of showers and even a slight chance of a thunderstorm over the inland Midwest, but again this all looks pretty light. And that front, as we've been going forward, the model guidance on that front has looked less and less impressive. So we're probably not going to see too much from that. It's not going to really be able to tap into much moisture either. So at best, probably a few mils through some of the ag areas over inland parts on Saturday and Sunday. And then we're back into another ridge for Monday. Could see another cold front push in on Tuesday and Wednesday. Maybe at best a moderate front. But again, probably going to struggle to have a whole lot in the gauge through the main ag region. So, it's not great news as far as those areas go. In terms of the temperatures, like I said, it is warming up a little bit on Friday. We're beneath a ridge of high pressure, so there are going to be some very patchy areas of frost over the next couple of nights, but we're talking about lowest temperatures around 1 or 2 degrees, so certainly not a hard frost. And then early next week, we are going to have another high build through on Monday and Tuesday mornings, so could see some areas of frost as well. Probably the coldest morning being Monday, where we could see some places getting below zero over the southern part of the Wheat Belt and into the Great Southern. But again, we're not talking about temperatures down around -5 or anything like that, so it's not going to be any hard frost.
All right. Thanks for going through that for us this afternoon, Bob. Appreciate that. 22-1, Richard Hudson here now with the rainfall results.
Yeah, so for the last 24 hours, the only area to get 5 mils or above was the southwest. So Cape Leeuwin had 7, Collie had 12, but that was over 2 days, Kawarumup 10, Donnybrook 5, Pemberton 8, Shannon 5, Walpole Forestry 7, and Windy Harbour had 6. But, Bill, you mentioned this earlier. Our ABC Midwest rural reporter, Joe Prendergast, was pretty keen to find out if possibly, and I will stress the word possibly, the most isolated egg producer in the world is worried about bird flu. So Joe headed off to Gabion Station, which is about 530 kilometres north of Perth and a few hundred kilometres inland from the Geraldton coast. And that's where Gemma Cripps and her partner Helen run about 150 hens on their cattle property. But Gemma says the chooks actually do more than just lay eggs. They also help restore the rangeland soils.
After doing a regen workshop, we decided that we just wanted to see what sort of different impacts we can create on the land here, and so we've been trying different things, and chooks was one of them.
So you're selling eggs, and you're selling eggs into Geraldton, but what else are the chickens bringing onto the station?
With the chickens, we're just trying to see what land changes we can create. Running the chooks on patches of land for a certain amount of time, the regen benefits that we're getting are pretty astounding. So, yeah.
So what happens when you say the regen?
Yeah, well, with the manure that the chooks are leaving behind and the way they scratch the dirt where they're grazing, it just lets the water infiltrate and creates fertiliser for the soil. And then, yeah, you see different changes in the flowers the following year and then also the feed quality that's there. You can see in this pen where the chooks were last time, they're really enjoying where they were and they're leaving a little patch up the end where they hadn't grazed last time.
So you're finding that where the chickens have been, the ground and therefore the plants are different. They're obviously tasting different.
They're healthier.
The chickens want to go back and eat them.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Do you see other physical changes when you look at it? Are plants appearing differently or anything like that?
Yeah, there's definitely physical changes. We've noticed before down at Gabion where we had the chooks for one season. The next year when the flowers came up, they were a different colour. So we can only put that to pH in the soil, I imagine, the changes there. But the main thing is how much healthier the plants are the following season and how much the animals want to eat it more than where they weren't previously.
So what colours did it go from?
There was more of a yellowy-white base that changed to a pink.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yep, the everlastings were a different colour and different species were coming up. So, and that's the other really cool thing. The plant diversity that comes up after animals have been heavily grazed, whether it's the cows or the chooks, yeah, it will change. So with the cattle, we're seeing a lot more grass coming back into the system. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So do you try and put the chickens where the cattle have been as well, try and get some of their manure into the soil?
That would be the ideal situation if you're on somewhere a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
Here, however, it's a little bit hard. This house paddock that we're in now, I mean, it's still 1,500 acres. So over summer, we will run a pretty big mob of cows in here for a really short amount of time. And then to graze the chooks over the top of that will be interesting.
So lots of experimenting by the
sound of it. Yeah, just trying to do things a bit different and have some fun along the way.
Yeah. At the moment, we're sitting surrounded by chooks who have got some beautiful wildflowers to eat as well as everything else that's coming up in this paddock. Do you find their eggs change throughout the season as well?
Yeah, definitely. The colour of the yolks, once we've moved, because they were on dry feed, obviously, because the season was a bit late. But once they moved onto this green, when you move pens and they move onto a really green flush, the eggs go really nice and orange.
Yeah.
So.
And you've got the chickens behind. It's a movable electric fence to keep them safe from predators coming in, but that allows you to pretty easily move where they're grazing. How do you keep them safe at night though?
Yeah, so yep, the fence is definitely excellent, so we're able to move that really easily. But to keep them safe at night, the chicken caravan that we have them in is all automated, so it will open and close itself. At the moment, with where that's like the daylight hours are now, it opens at 6:30 in the morning and it shuts at 6:30 at night. So I don't have to remember to shut it, which is great, but it keeps them safe and it also teaches them where to lay their eggs. Mm. So although they're free range, we don't have to do an egg hunt every day. They lay in the chicken house.
So do you call this a pastured setup, free range? What is it?
Yeah, I'd call it pastured. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do people seem to want to buy pastured eggs? Is there demand for this type of system?
Yeah, definitely. Yep, people are certainly starting to want to know that the animals that they're getting their food from have been looked after and they've got the best opportunities. So by running the chooks like this, we can sort of tick those boxes saying that they've got a pretty good life and producing some pretty good eggs.
You must be one of the most remote egg producers in the state. Here at Yalgoo, you're on a station. Don't think there's many other setups like this.
No, I'm not. I don't know of any other stations that have got chooks on this level. So, yeah, possibly.
Do you think when you look at the egg industry and the obvious threat is bird flu being found in the state, it's not in any commercial egg facilities, but it is in the state. How have you thought about that and what you're doing here?
Yeah, we have thought about that a lot. And hopefully with our remote location, we are far enough away from the threat that, yeah, hopefully we'll be okay. We sort of definitely want to keep the birds as a free range operation, so if it had to be having the animals contained, I'm not really quite sure how we'd go about that. So hopefully our remote location will keep us okay.
And you are registered as a commercial egg producer.
Yep.
How much information has there been flowing from government about bird flu, what to do, what would happen if it is found in a flock?
Yeah, we're sort of getting updates every time there's a new case that's been discovered. So, and there's been a lot of online forums in the past couple of weeks on all the issues relating to the egg industry and the birds. So, yeah, they have been very good.
Do you know what would happen? Like, would you get a housing order or something like that?
Yeah, that's possibly what they are looking at, is the housing orders. Unfortunately for us here, that probably, to make that happen would be very difficult. So, our quarantine procedure at the moment would probably be having to cull the chickens. Yep. It's just to try and create housing for birds out here is completely against what we're trying to do. So it wouldn't really achieve anything. But, yeah, keeping the animals safe for a small amount of time could be possible, but it just depends how that housing order looks.
Are you recognised as more protected because you are geographically isolated? I imagine there's not too many seabirds cruising around here.
That's what they are staying at the moment because, of where we are. Off the coast by sort of 100 k's, they're saying, is the first barrier.
And so, you're about, what, 250?
It would be 200. Yeah, as to the ocean would be about 200 from here. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will be enough.
Do you flip that and go, well, this is an opportunity to expand and have more chickens?
Yeah, well, it possibly could be. As this sort of goes along, having the ability to sort of hatch and breed our own chickens now, it's something that we could definitely sort of keep going ahead with further. But, yeah, it's just making sure that you have got the markets for those eggs too. There's definitely a cost to running the chickens out here because of freight and getting your feed here. So the return's got to be there also.
Gemma Cripps from Gabion Station near Yalgoo and her chickens there, talking to Joe Prendergast. And if you'd like to see what the Chooks playing area looks like right now, you can just search online ABC and Midwest. And that's where you'll find Joe's story and some great photos too of the chickens and their setup there. Just search ABC Midwest. 13 minutes to one. Well, the state government is going to use its new $13.7 million fisheries patrol vessel, the Equinox, to monitor for bird flu across WA's remote northern coastline. The new boat replaces DPIRD's ageing patrol vessel, the Walcott, and will be based out of Broome when it becomes operational next month. Now, its main job is to patrol northern waters across the Kimberley with a focus on commercial and recreational fisheries compliance and marine park management. It will also assist with marine safety, sea search and rescue, shark incident response, whale disentanglement and illegal foreign fishing interception. And now, following the detection of the deadly strain of bird flu in Australia, it will also provide an important additional capability for monitoring remote islands, coastal areas and wildlife populations for any emerging biosecurity threats. 12 minutes to one.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll head to Katanning just before the news at one for the results of the sheep market. First, though, BCI Minerals will create a pilot plant to produce sulphate of potash fertiliser at its Mardy salt operations, about 80 kilometres south of Karratha. General Manager David Boshoff says salt production will remain the focus at the site. But if they can successfully produce the fertiliser as a byproduct, farmers will benefit.
Yeah, it's interesting. Seawater is an amazing resource. Of course, it has salt in it, as everyone would know, but it also contains many other minerals. And one of those minerals is the sulfates, so sulfates of potash. They crystallize in what we call KTMS salt, and that salt then gets washed into processed into a sulfate of potash fertilizer. And that's a potassium-based fertilizer that is really important for the production of high-value crops. So if you think about the production of wine or grapes, avocados, nuts, citrus, some of those type of products, some of those produce, that's what typically get, they use SOP or sulfate of potash for that.
And how integral is this sulfate of potash element to BCI Minerals' Mardy project?
The good news is that the salt part of our process is the primary revenue stream, and that underlines all our profitability. The salt project is fully funded, and the sulfate of potash is a byproduct that gets produced through the same process. So ultimately, it is upside for investors, of course, in our project, but it doesn't necessarily make a significant difference in the salt part, because the salt part is standing on its own 2 feet. But I'm very excited about this, because sulfate of potash has always been part of our vision, and we've now made a big step forward in making that a reality.
We know this is just a pilot, but who are the intended customers should the pilot go well and this be looked at moving into a commercial venture?
Well, Kimberly, I'm very excited about providing this type of product to domestic customers in WA, but also in the rest of Australia. We import all of our sulfate of potash currently, and to be able to be part of that supply chain into Australia is really exciting. We also think it'll be available for the international market. Of course, Australia is not the largest consumer of sulfate of potash, but to be able to be part of the local story and be able to be part of food security just here in the state we live in is pretty exciting.
And Mardy Salt is expected to be, is it the biggest producer of salt in Australia?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it'll be the single biggest operation in Australia and the third biggest in the world.
So what would that mean for the production of sulfate of potash? What would that look like in terms of at full operation? How much sulfate of potash would it be producing, again, provided all goes well?
Yeah, Kimberly. So we've always stated to the market that we expect approximately 140,000 tonnes of sulfate of potash. As you mentioned, it'll have to be proven through the piloting process and demonstrate that we can do that. So that's the number that we shared externally. And once we're done with the piloting, of course, we'll work through that and see if that is still correct.
The other part of BCI Minerals that I find really interesting is that it is 99% powered by solar and wind energy. Would this still be the case with the production of sulfate of potash?
To evaporate salt, the main energy source is the sun that allows water to evaporate. And in the wintertime, wind actually plays the primary role to evaporate seawater. And so the energy that's required to convert seawater into the ultimate final product, as you stated correctly, more than 99% of that energy is actually from those natural processes. That doesn't change for sulfate of potash, because sulfate of potash is also a salt that gets crystallized on site through evaporation. Of course, the energy used to run plants and other pumps and so on, that is the other 0.001% that is part of that equation.
Now, just a quick update on Mardy Salt as well. You mentioned that Mardy Salt is producing salt earlier. Is it at full production capacity?
We're not yet at full production. One of the amazing things about salt, producing salt, is you are reliant on weather and these natural processes. So it'll take us approximately 2 years to get to full production from where we are today. We are currently crystallizing salt and we'll start exporting salt early next year. But to get to the full run rate of 5.35 million tonnes per annum, that'll take us to the back end of 28.
BCI Minerals General Manager David Boshoff speaking to Kimberly Putland about the pilot sulfate of potash project and salt operations at Mardy, just south of Karratha in the Pilbara. 7 minutes to 1. 4 people connected with the pork meat industry have been charged over alleged large-scale financial crimes that saw tens of millions of dollars funneled out of businesses for personal use. The charges follow a joint investigation in New South Wales and Queensland. Kelly Buchanan has been following the story, and Michael Condon asked her what's known about the case.
The individuals are two from Queensland and two from New South Wales, and they're all business owners or representatives of the pork meat industry. Now, it's alleged that they kept $10 million in sales off the books for personal use and that they moved more than $30 million in cash between the two states in freight vehicles between 2017 and 2026. Now, the two individuals from Queensland have been accused also of fraudulently relabeling frozen meat products to alter the production and best before dates, although authorities have confirmed that that practice has not posed any risk to food safety. And more than $25 million worth of assets, including $3 million in cash and two motor vehicles, have been seized as suspected proceeds of these alleged crimes.
Wow, that's an interesting case. What charges have been laid?
Well, the Queenslanders have been charged with offences including fraud, destroying records, receiving tainted property and making false declarations. And they'll both appear in the Brisbane Magistrates Court on the 14th of September. The two individuals from New South Wales are facing charges related to the destruction of records with the intent to defraud. And these charges follow a joint investigation that involved the Queensland Crime and Corruption Commission, the New South Wales Police Anti-Money Laundering Unit and the New South Wales Crime Commission. And those authorities say it was a complex cross-border case and operation to unravel these financial crimes.
So what's the pork industry saying?
Well, the pork industry is not saying much. In a statement, Australian Pork Limited said it was aware of the media reports on the matter and that all businesses must follow the law, but it would not comment any further while the matter was before the courts. And we've reached out to several pork operations in Queensland today. Most are not commenting. Of course, Queensland accounts for about a quarter of the pork production in the country, so it is a significant industry in this state.
Queensland Country Hour presenter Kelly Buchanan going through the details of those alleged large-scale financial crimes that saw tens of millions of dollars funneled out of businesses for personal use. This is in the pork industry. So if you want to read more, Kelly's got an online story up for you. Just search ABC Rural and Pork, and that's where you'll find more details. 4 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. The Swans scandal continues with five players to be stood down for the rest of the season amid an ongoing police investigation. A Thai teenager allegedly murdered by an Australian man suffocated to death, an autopsy reveals. Triple murderer Erin Patterson's appeal against her convictions back in court today. And what will this summer's bushfire season hold? Hear the very latest forecast. Join me for The World Today.
3.5 minutes to one. Let's get to the market. At the Katanning sale yards this morning, sheep numbers were up and prices were down a little bit. The final tally was 10,350. So that's up 2,685 on last week's numbers. Tracy Kilner, hello. Can you run through the figures?
A good run of heavy lambs eased with demand, selling to a top of $293. While a large margin of the lesser weights lack quality, easing up to $30 a head. Restockers were keen to secure good-framed Merino ewe lambs paying up to $233. Mutton numbers were equal to last week with prices easing with demand. Heavyweight ewes topped at $252 a head. Lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from $30 to $158. Heavier lambs sold to $184. Trade weight lambs made from $165 to $241. While the heavyweights under 24 kilos carcass weight sold from $210 to $267. And extra heavyweights topped at $293. Ram lambs sold mainly to processors for $68 to $220. Weight dependent. Merino store weather hoggets sold for $120 to $148. Medium weights made $165 to $170. And the heavyweights returned $222 a head. Merino ewe hoggets made $189 for medium weights. Store ewe mutton eased, selling from $50 to $180 with a fleece. The prime medium weight ewes returned $170 to $206. Heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $210 to $252. Mature store weathers returned $150 to $160, while medium weights sold from $170 to $200 and heavy weights sold to $229 a head. Mature rams made from $70 to $208 to processors, and a pen of crossbred rams sold to a restocker for $242 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. About a minute and a half away from the news at 1 o'clock. And a couple of texts to finish off. We've been talking about the CBH Group's new locos, and some of the locals, especially around Mount Barker, are saying that there's a lot of noise and vibrations coming from these new loco trains. This on the text from Dennis in Badgingarra, growling about trains, try living near wind turbines. This too, the new trains shake the houses in Pingaring, which is about 350 kilometres southeast of Perth and about 45 kilometres east of Coolin. We also caught up with Nicole Giblet from Newton Orchards in Manjimup, growing a range of fruits and talking about the federal government's decision to slow the process of visa applications for working holiday makers, which she thinks might put off workers coming to Australia. This on the text from Amanda in Albany. We've had excellent backpackers and locals, as well as useless ones. Backpackers are essential to small seasonal producers, and the conditions for their 88 days are quite restrictive. And I'll just have to be brief. Thank you for your text, Pauline. I can't read all of it because the news is upon me, but she says WA needs backpackers. They're helpful at roadhouses, hotels and traffic companies too. Thank you. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.